Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Christy Dames, with the club's Business and Leadership Forum, and your host for today's program, which is entitled Startup, Entrepreneurs, and Ninja Innovation. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine programs that we have here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you your host for this evening, Kevin O'Malley, president of Tech Talk Studio and chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum.
Hello, everybody. I'm really glad to be here tonight. I'm very happy to introduce our guests, Steve Blank and Gary Shapiro. I am the moderator tonight, but this is really going to be a conversation between Gary and Steve, and then a conversation with you all in the audience. If you could please start thinking about your questions and pass them over as we go. We probably won't be able to answer all of them, but we're going to do our best. So, Steve Blank is the author of Four Steps to the Epiphany, a major figure in Silicon Valley. Gary Shapiro, major figure in Washington, D.C. and around the world, the president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association, the author of Ninja Innovation, and the man behind the CES show in Las Vegas in January. So let me just ask you both, Steve, can you tell me, everybody here probably knows, but what are the four steps to the epiphany?
Yeah. So the four steps to the epiphany, it's actually the four key components of the customer development process. Customer discovery, customer validation, customer creation, and company building. And that's part of the bigger lean startup movement, which includes business model design, customer development, and agile engineering.
Great. And Gary, so since we're talking about ninja innovation, you have a relatively new book. It's a New York Times bestseller on ninja innovation. What does that mean?
Ninja innovation is a phrase that describes what you must be to be an innovator. You must be a ninja. The ninjas were ancient Japanese fighters that were always outmanned and outgunned. And they had to be clever, flexible, strategic, build a phenomenal team, and be able to respond to adversity and win against overwhelming odds.
Great. Well, so our program tonight is Startups, Entrepreneurs, and Ninja Innovation. I want to address startups in general, but also how we can apply the startup mentality inside larger organizations. I think a number of people here today do want to do their own startups. Some other people are here because they are in larger organizations and want to insert that. So now, can you tell us a little bit about what's happening at CES and the shift to smaller organizations, startups, entrepreneurs, what you're doing with Eureka Park?
Sure. The International CES, for those that don't know, is the largest innovation event in the world. It's held every January in Las Vegas. It attracts over 150,000 people from around the world, including 35,000 people from abroad. There are 3,000 companies that exhibit. It attracts over 5,000 journalists. And it really is a meeting place, not only for the consumer electronics industry, but for every industry that touches it, whether it's the automobile or broadcast, cable, satellite, healthcare. And we're finding people that want to see the future come to CES. At my very first meeting of our board in 1981, I was very impressed that the board was discussing a change in exhibit space cost. And the largest exhibitor was the board chairman and said, look, we could afford it. It's a rounding error for us. But we always have to make the CES open to any innovative company, anyone with an idea in the garage, to make it for a few thousand dollars. They could get national, international distribution, letters of credit, investors, partners, retailers, media coverage. And that has been our philosophy going forward. Last year, we decided to expand it by starting something called Eureka Park. Our goal was 30 companies, and we wanted pure startups. We partnered with the National Science Foundation and Startup America. It was curated. You had to get through some hurdles to get in. And we ended up with over 100 companies. We did it again this year. We ended up with over 150. We're doing it again for next year, and we're going to be well over that amount. And it's very interesting because you go there, it's just a buzzing, exciting area of the show. These are people that have probably never been in a trade show before. A lot of them are former scientists and engineers who were with a big company, and they were either pushed out or they had an idea on their own. Others are just people with an idea, and they want to expose it. And that's the essence of what we are as a trade show, as a nation, and even as a world, where anyone with a great idea should be able to expose it in a very live, five-sense experience basis with other people and see if they want to do business together, if it's a good idea. And many will fail, but many will succeed.
That's great. At this point, I just do want to let our audience here and people listening at home know we do have a hashtag for today. If you're tweeting, That hashtag is Startup Ninjas, with an S on the end. Startup Ninjas. Steve is at SG blank. Gary is at Gary Shapiro, all one word. Mine is at Sober Dervish, SoberDervish. And if you don't know what that means, you can talk to me afterwards. So, Steve, tell me, why is this startup thing taken off so much? Why now? What's happening?
Yeah, so a couple of interesting things have converged in the last 10 years. Some of them based on theories we've had, but others on real practice. So first of all, the explosion of web, mobile, and cloud apps meant that entrepreneurs can now start companies without needing to raise millions of dollars for buying hardware and software. The problem is we had no processes that actually took into account that I can now start a company on a laptop and get a minimum viable product out in weeks, if not months. And we really needed some theory on how that would work. And so some of the work I did a decade ago is I was a serial entrepreneur for 21 years and did 8 startups. I started teaching and then thinking about entrepreneurship. And I'd say the biggest idea I had was as follows. And that is that startups are not smaller versions of large companies. And large companies execute known business models, but startups search for them. And while we had 100 years of building tools and strategies for execution in business schools, there were no tools for entrepreneurs to search. And so my work, Eric Ries's work, Alexander Osterwalder's work in the last 5 or 10 years has to build a management stack for founders to start thinking about how to think about startups differently than early stage ventures. And the irony is, of course, it started for tools for startups, but this month the whole idea was now the cover of this month's Harvard Business Review, The Lean Startup Changes Everything, is the story about how these same tools and techniques could be applied to large corporations.
Now, Eric Ries was your student, right? He came to you for money, and you made him take your class?
That's the short version. I actually funded Eric's previous company with a past VP of engineering of mine, Will Harvey, who was Eric's boss. Eric and Will then started IMVU. And before I would write Will another check, I said, you know, we screwed it up the last time. Maybe you guys could sit through the class and learn something. And the joke was at the time is as they were driving home from the class in Berkeley, Will was going, what a waste of time. And Eric was going, oh, my God, this changes everything. And Eric became the first practitioner ever in the whole world of customer development and coupled it with agile engineering. And actually, I sat on his board, and we practiced some of these techniques, et cetera. And then Eric published The Lean Startup and has been the Johnny Appleseed of kind of the whole movement. He's done a spectacular job in evangelizing these concepts. And then Alexander Osterwalder came around and wrote a book called Business Model Generation that provided a framework for Lean. And so we now have the beginning of a stack of tools that we can start thinking about.
So, Gary, what's your advice for startups and people who want to bring a startup mentality into their company based on Ninja Innovation and based on your experience of 30 years in consumer electronics?
Read his book.
And then what's the advice from your book?
Well, read his book.
You know, there is a major difference, and I agree, between a startup and a large company. And I speak to a lot of people from large companies who are frustrated. They want to be innovators, but the large company has everything going against it to become entrepreneurial. I mean, you have every large company has something they've been successful at, and they try to preserve it. And that's the number one thing to do is to preserve what you've been good at. That makes it, having something new, very difficult. So, you know, one approach is like Steve Jobs took is you basically create a separate group of people, keep it secret, and have really good people and have them focus on your vision. Another approach is like what 3M takes, which is say we must have half our products must be new over the next few years. You incentivize people on that basis. Another approach is to make sure you have a way of listening to the people from the front line who usually have the best ideas, and you remove the layers of management so you can go right to the top and get things approved, or you have a startup fund. You reward people taking risks. I think the challenge for larger companies is that risk-taking is not rewarded. And I think the difference is in a startup, that's what you're doing. You're risking everything. I mean, statistically, it may not be the brightest thing to do is to be a startup. It's like being a, an urban youth and trying to get into the NBA. The odds are against you, but the payoff is potentially huge. And it's what makes us great. It's what we do as a nation. It's who we are. It's a lot of our immigrant bias. It's why our kids ask why not, and they're not great at rote. But all the things that we are as a nation lead up to us being innovators and entrepreneurs. And large companies face a challenge that way. The first thing of addressing a problem is recognizing it. They have a problem as large companies. And when you talk to CEOs of the largest companies, this is what they're frustrated about. They're good at what they've done. I don't want to single out any company. But when the CEO has the vision, like take Jeff Bezos of Amazon. I mean, not only did he build up a great company on the web selling product, but he tried to destroy their book selling, which was the dominant thing at the time, with e-books. And everyone, including me, thought he was crazy. But he was willing to destroy his own company to create a competition, and he succeeded at it. And there's a lot of companies that have reinvented themselves, whether it's IBM or Motorola. They've seemed to reinvent themselves every 10 years or so and got a totally different business model from what they were. And that was really, it seemed at least from the outside, top-down management and a strategy which was imposed on the company in part because their old business model wasn't going to work. You know, mainframes were going away CB radios were no longer the hit anymore for Motorola. So it depends on the company and the strategy, but it is difficult and it is different.
So let's just keep riffing on that idea. I think that's a really interesting observation. And for those of you, how many of you are in this audience or in large companies or have worked in one? Anybody? Oh, good. Look at that. I'd say at least half.
A large number.
So here's what's really interesting, is that in the 1990s, a new title emerged in corporations. It was the CIO, right? Technology used to be managed by the finance department, then we called it the MIS department. Then it became more and more strategic, and we actually made it a C-level position. Here in the 21st century, something interesting is going on in Fortune 1000 companies, and I think you nailed it. There's a new title, which since I've been out of corporations for a decade, just blew me away. That new title is called the VP of Innovation. It's now in at least right. Half of Fortune 1000 companies. Now, what's really interesting is not the title, but why the title? Why is it there, and what are they trying to accomplish? And I think you just gave us a rundown of some of the issues, but let me summarize them. What's happened to American corporations and international corporations in the last decade is they've been doing the same stuff, but it's no longer working. And why it's no longer working, it's not because they've gotten dumber, but the world has changed around them. Globalization, China Inc. for manufacturing, new startups entering, instantaneous information across the internet. Every corporation in the world now needs to deal with continuous disruption. Continuous. And business models and markets that used to last for decades now disappear. And where the battle used to be, remember GE, I'm going to be number one or number two or get out of the market. Now it's no longer just about market share. It's about new market creation. Oh, it's who could create new markets faster than competitors. The problem is all the old tools we had, management tools, technology tools, etc., that stuff doesn't work as well. And it's not we've gotten dumber. So therefore, the role of VP of Innovation. But, can I give you the but? It turns out, what's going on today is actually what happened in the 1920s. 1920s, for those of you not old enough to remember, is that American corporations just had one type of organization, functional organizations. That is, you had a sales department, a manufacturing department, a marketing department. But those companies now had to deal with sales across the United States and multiple product lines. And those organizations broke down in trying to deal with that. And in the 1920s, five American companies invented a new type of organization called divisionalization. First DuPont, then General Motors, then Sears, then Standard Oil, figured out that the problem wasn't organization first, it was a strategy problem, that they all had the same strategic problem they needed to address. And what they did was invent a new way to organize. Why do I tell you this story? Because I think every corporation today is dealing with the same class of issue. The existing organizations, which were designed to do something very different, are no longer working in a continuous disruption world. We used to have advanced R&D departments, M&A departments, venture capital groups, business units and something else over here. And we're slowly starting to evolve a new class of organization where innovation isn't by exception, but it's built into the DNA of large corporations. And the irony back to why the Harvard Business Review put lean on the cover is that large corporations are now looking to startups for how to take those fast, rapid, agile processes and integrate them inside. So sorry for the soliloquy, but I just wanted to tie into what you said. And we happen to be teaching some companies on how to do this, and they're all hungry for this knowledge because it's a matter of life and death and survival.
Thank you. Gary, with your membership, which is diverse and both in size and in what they do, what are the trends that you're seeing and the changes that correspond to what Steve's talking about?
Well, you know, Steve hit a nail on the head. And one of the strategies that we haven't talked about is if you can't innovate, you acquire innovation. You buy the small company startup, and sometimes you suck the life out of it. I've seen repeatedly, at least 40 or 50 times, smaller companies are bought. The CEO is very excited. Oh, it's a great partnership. And, of course, the CEO is always gone within 12 months, which is 98% of the time. So that is a strategy, it's the make or buy decision. But in terms of other, the biggest trend is the speed of change. Everyone approaches life, not only as a company, but we do it as individuals, where we think that today is going to be how the rest of the future is going to be. We look at the picture today, and that's a status quo, and we try to preserve it. In reality, and even companies, they're making decisions on factories, on what product categories they go into, and they follow each other. And it's a terrible strategy to follow other companies, because usually the first one or two companies to market win. And you can look at that in tablets, for example. You know, although Microsoft was there first, Apple was there with something which people bought. Samsung jumped in, as did 50 other companies. And, you know, those 50 companies, most of them are gone now. But they all do it thinking that no one else is looking at the same data there, so they jump in. And I think they have to get away from that. You have to be different. And it is a time in history which is unbelievable. As Steve said, I mean, you have the only time in history where anyone with a broadband connection essentially could start an international company. That is, the barriers to entry have gone down close to zero, which is great for the world. It is phenomenal, but it is a challenge. And it's the U.S. advantages that used to be there are no longer there. I mean, what we do have is intelligence. We have the best and brightest. We've been hurting that with our immigration policy. We have a lot of challenges, though. I'm happy to talk about those.
Great. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Startups, Entrepreneurs, and Ninja Innovation with Gary Shapiro and Steve Blank. If you're tweeting, the hashtag is Startup Ninjas with an S. Hashtag Startup Ninjas at Gary Shapiro and at SG Blank. So now, what can we tell people about how can people who are here get into the game?
Steve?
So, you know, it depends which game. But, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, one of the interesting things I used to get asked, having been a practitioner and now an educator, is, you know, how can you teach entrepreneurship, Steve? You're just kind of born with it, you know. And I think that was a really interesting question. And for a decade, I kind of struggled with that is, gee, you know, I'm teaching it, but is this worth doing? Until I realized we were asking the wrong question. Of course you could teach entrepreneurship. The question is that should really be asked is, who can you teach entrepreneurship to? It's a big idea. The mistake was thinking that this is some craft. Entrepreneurship is not a craft. Entrepreneurship is a passion. You can only teach entrepreneurship to people who desperately want to learn it. So it's a huge distinction. You could teach entrepreneurship the way you could teach music, painting, sculpture, and art. That is, we've now done that for thousands of years, but we don't divide the room and say, yeah, this side of the room is going to be learning how to paint, and this side of the room is going to be working in the factory, and somehow get equal results. It has to be something that, in fact, comes from inside of you, and you desperately want to learn how to do, and it has to be something you want to bring from inside of you out. It's an act of creation. And if you want to do that, this generation of entrepreneurs, particularly those in entrepreneurial clusters like Silicon Valley and New York, but almost every other city in the U.S., is blessed with access to the Internet, access to lectures, access to meetups, access to entrepreneurial communities where knowledge used to be clustered. You know, in Silicon Valley, and you used to have coffee once a month, and the data would kind of travel at about 10 bits per sip of coffee. Now it's your kind of bandwidth unlimited on how to learn. Biggest problem my students have is being able to filter out whose advice to take, not whether you could take enough advice.
Mm-hmm. So, Gary, how do you find, I think people don't know that CEA, there's a whole lot more than just put on this one big show in January. You have a lot of education as part of what you do. How does that fit into what you're doing?
Yeah, 80% of our members are smaller businesses, and we offer services. You know, first of all, if you want to get financing, you need data and hard facts. So we have market sizes for almost everything. We count the widgets that are sold. We provide basic research about what consumers want on a searchable database that goes back 20 years and is breakable by every possible category, feature, you name it. But we also offer a lot to help small businesses, not only at CES, but we, you know, one of the things is mentoring. It's reality is when you're an entrepreneur, you have to have the passion, you have to have a good idea, but you also have to run essentially a business. And whether it's a small business or a large business, there are certain things you have to deal with. And it's not knowledge which is intuitive or comes naturally. And you shouldn't be reinventing the wheel on that stuff. That's why you're talking about a lean company, right?
Let me give Gary's organization a plug. How many of you have been to CES? How many of you have been to a trade show at all? Great. So some of you might know one of my shticks is there are no facts inside the building, so get the hell out. And as part of that, it's not only talk to customers, but I insist that my students or entrepreneurs who are building potential companies go to the trade shows and their businesses, not to exhibit at first, but actually to connect and try to understand kind of the order of battle of who are the players, what are the buzzwords, who are the people you need to meet. There's no better place to do that than the world's largest trade show, CES being the great example of it, if you happen to be anywhere tangentially in that business. And if it's not CES, pick your other shows. But I'm a big advocate of this. You know, people once said, well, virtual trade shows are going to replace physical trade shows. When I started in the computer business, the phrase was, oh, we're going to have the paperless office. Well, once we invent computers, and some of you might know that we now generate 10x more paper with computers than we did before. And so the line I used was the paperless office would happen the day we have the paperless bathroom. And I think we'll have a virtual trade show the day we have the same thing. So I just want to give a plug for...
Thank you.
There's immense value in how human beings tend to collect data because they collect them in context. The other one, though, you mentioned is about market research data. It used to be that the way we started startups was we wrote a business plan by doing a lot of research and sat in market research libraries and sized the market, et cetera. I now remind my students that market research data is awesome at predicting the past. Because if they could predict the future, they'd be hedge funds. And so it's great data, but you want it in context with, you know, the ground truth of getting out into the customers and in the conferences, and you want other truth, which is the market data. So you want this in context as well. So sorry,
I agree with everything you said, except we've done a pretty good job of predicting the
future. I always love that line. I agree with everything you said, but you're an idiot.
No, you're not an idiot, but the truth is we project the future also, and we have a phenomenal track record. We've been 10 years right on HDTV sales. We're right out there on 3D. Okay. We've done some great things in terms of things are going that are predictable. Now, there are certain things which are inevitable, and there is business opportunities there. There's driverless cars. There's 3D printing, which is clear. There's robotics. There's nanotechnology. There's all sorts of areas. There's wireless health, which is clear. There's so many things which are happening. We're such a great place in history. We're sensing technology and robotics and nanotechnology. And the technology is there. The applications world is there. Smart people are going to figure out how to work it and put it together and create businesses. And that's a really, really important thing. And I agree with you about virtual trade shows. I mean, every few weeks someone calls me and tells me why we should have virtual trade shows and they'll solve all our problems and make us a ton of money. And for 15 years now, I've said we're not interested. And what's ironic is in my job as the head of the Consumer Electronics Association, one of the largest organizations in Washington for any industry, is to be out there and be a cheerleader for technology and innovation. And I am, and I'm passionate about it and I believe in it. At the same time, I'm also passionate about the live interactive experience. You're in this room here because you wanted to see us and figure out what we say firsthand. Same thing with a trade show. You use your five senses. You determine whether you're going to trust someone. You go out there, you meet people, and there's a large value in serendipity, frankly, the technology hasn't quite figured out how to deal with, is you have things that just happen. You meet people. You have business relationships. And it's much more likely to happen in an environment with similar people looking after the same industry. So I am passionate about trade shows, meetings, conferences, and events like this one.
Good. I'm starting to get audience questions. I have some more of my own, but if we run out of questions, I'll come back to mine. But I've gotten four different questions here about women of color, people of color, women. What are the barriers to entry, and how are the ways around that to bring? Now, Gary, your organization, a lot of your leadership are women, right?
70% of our 150 employees are women. Yeah, it's a challenge, especially because a lot of younger women, and we have a lot of babies. I think we've had like 15 in the last year. But that's fine.
The women have had babies.
Yeah, well, they're all part of our family at this point. In one sense, the answer is technology is sex and race and everything neutral. On the other hand, you can't ignore the stark reality that there's a lot of white males running around making the funding decisions, heading companies, things like that. And as someone who's helping select 900 speakers at our different events, including the CES, boy, we go for diversity in a big way. We go for diversity in our board in every possible way. But it's difficult because everyone's going after the same people we are to speak. And it's difficult. And certainly Sheryl Sandberg's book, I want to meet one guy that has read Sheryl Sandberg's book. So if I ask how many have read it, I'll see a bunch of women raise their hands. No? Is there a guy that's read Sheryl Sandberg's book? Okay. Why? It's not just a woman's. Okay, I'm going to read it. So I ask this question next audience. I'll be able to be more honest about it. But it's an issue. My wife is, in a sense, a scientist. She's a surgeon. And I know what she faced. And it's difficult. It's difficult. And I don't pretend to have the answer. But I do know in the course of my speaking about the book and going around the country, I meet so many different people that are heading groups to get women in STEM. And women, there's a lot of support out there. There's a lot of scholarships. There's a lot of well-meaning people trying to make it happen, but we just haven't gotten there yet. And I don't know the answer.
Steve, what do you find in your classes and your webcasts around the world? What's the breakdown?
I'm going to declare this question past my pay grade. But I will tell you that I did write a blog post on this. I write a blog called steveblank.com. And if you search on the web for a post labeled Boys Rules, Girls Lose, you'll get my opinion and my advice that I gave my daughters who were about to go to college about playing as women in a male-dominated game. And it was advice for my daughters, but I shared it online and you could read it.
Can you give us a one-minute recap?
I just did. It's Boys Rules, Girls Lose. And that the biggest... And my wife was a Stanford MBA in the 80s, was the second evangelist at Apple. And so our kids were raised where, girls could do anything, blah, blah, blah. And when they became young women, I sat them down past the facts of life conversation about the fact of women in business, which is the thing you need to understand, at least as I explained it to my daughters, I can't speak for others, is that unconsciously the rules are set by boys in business. And if you watch how boys grow up as kids, you give them two sticks, and the next thing you know, they're banging themselves on the head with it or banging each other on sticks. That's not necessarily what women tend to do. And again, there's kind of a bell curve of distribution about how the sexes tend to interact with each other, but women tend to collaborate, and boys tend to have zero-sum games. If you don't understand the game that's being set and who's setting it, then it's hard to understand what the rules are. And so my advice to my girls becoming women was, first step is, if you think they're playing soccer but they're carrying sticks, they might be playing field hockey and you're going to get brained. So understand the rule of the game before you get out into the field. And there were more pieces of tactical advice. And as I said, it was for my daughters. I can't give advice to other people's children. I tend to invest in and encourage the women entrepreneurs that I have in my class. In fact, I just wrote a blog post about one of them called Ruminate, which were basically building science, technology, engineering, and math kits for young girls to get them engaged in science early on. And I wrote a check for them as soon as they graduated my class.
That's great. Well, one of the questions that I want to ask is on the topic of stealth. So you just had an HBR featured article that was on the cover. You talked about stealth. If I paraphrase, maybe stealth is dead for startups.
Actually, stealth is dumb. It's probably a better paraphrase.
Stealth is dumb, okay. But Gary, so in your book, Ninja Innovation, you talk about the need for stealth, but it's a very interesting contrast in the chapter about when you need to utilize stealth and when you need to utilize allies. So, Gary, from your experience over the last 30 years, do you advise keeping a low profile? Do you advise getting out there talking to people? How do you know how to balance all this?
Well, I think Steve is absolutely right. If you're not talking to potential customers, you're crazy. On the other hand, there's a difference between apps and software and hardware. Sometimes you really have to be quiet, and sometimes you have to test your product and talk to people. And it's your strategy. In most cases, Steve's probably absolutely right. But sometimes you have to be out there with something, and it could be just a head fake. You might want to fake out your competition and, you know, talk about a product and features which may not even exist. And that's pretty ninja-esque to me. I don't think it's illegal, unethical, or immoral. That's competition. And it depends what you're doing. There's 1,000 different areas and other things outside of Silicon Valley that people are doing, the different kinds of products, and whether it's toothpaste or life insurance. And you're out there, you're always competing. So it depends upon your strategy, whether you want to be stealthy, whether you want to do reality testing, whether you want to go out big, whether you want to test. You know, everyone knows the story of New Coke and things like that, where they went out big, perhaps before they should have. And other failures that have been out there with a lack of perhaps stealth, where they should have had stealth. So I think it's situational, and it depends upon the category you're in.
So let me disagree. I don't think it's situational at
all. Okay.
I think this is not a game of semantics to the extent what stealth means, but I think we're confusing product launch and announcement with getting out of the building and talking to customers. Does anybody remember Google's announcement? Anybody remember that announcement date? They never had one. Okay, it's a big idea. Google never announced the product. Amazon never announced their product. One of the things that when I talk about Lean Startup, and Eric does as well, getting out of the building is not announcing your product. Even putting up a website, you know, every entrepreneur thinks if I put my product up online, you know, I'm going to announce. Bad news, guys, no one cares. Right? It's a big idea. No one cares. When you're a startup, you've actually got to pay money for, you know, acquisition and activation, not like you're going to have to fight off demand. Most of the students I teach, they think the biggest problem is to get a big enough building so they could put the bags of money in the, you know, in the right place. When I try to explain them, that's not the problem at all. So what we confuse is when we use the word stealth, I'm talking about you need to get out and be getting as much customer feedback as you can.
Did Steve Jobs do that?
So this is an interesting conversation because the Jobs PR machine actually did a major disservice to entrepreneurs worldwide and probably permanently damaged the craft. Steve Jobs did not sit in a lead-lined room in a Zen Lotus position with lightning bolts coming out of his head. I mean, as much as Apple PR would like you to think that, it didn't happen that way. Jobs was probably one of the most connected and intuitive entrepreneurs there was. He understood where the technology was. Here, let me give you an example. Does anybody remember when Steve Jobs was healthy, there would be a Jobs sighting once a month of some email he answered? Does anybody remember that? You know, and the answers from Jobs had two types of answers, either no or fuck you. And I'm sure you can't broadcast that, but basically there were two types of answers. I finally got you to smile. But think about it. No one took that to the next step. Do you think that was the only email that month that Jobs read? Of course not. Jobs was reading every customer email that came to him, and that the ones that were relevant that he kept seeing again, he actually gave an answer, and the world started buzzing about that answer. The other Jobs comment was when the Apple Store in Palo Alto opened, it was about a half a mile from his house. And luckily, I lived half a mile in the other direction. But I would go downtown Palo Alto and see Jobs in the store, you know, at least once a week. Now, other people saw him, but no one bothered to ask, do you think Steve Jobs could have gotten a Mac delivered to his house? Because what the heck was he doing in the store?
Market research.
Right. And I'm sure he would never admit that he was actually doing market research, because the Jobs PR shtick was, oh, it all came from, you know, just thinking, and there was no input at all. Jobs was probably the world's best product synthesizer on the planet. let's give him his due. He was up there with the founder of Sony, with Edward Land, and probably with Elon Musk now in the 21st century. There probably wasn't much better, but it did not happen in a vacuum. He was integrating data probably as well as any entrepreneur ever did. So, sorry for the soliloquy. Did you? I think you were going to ask us some audience
just,
questions.
No, he's just in your thing. You know, you've just kept us off National Public Radio.
Yeah, I know.
That's what he's thinking.
Well, I'm just hoping for the bleep.
There goes my NPR show. Gary, what do you think is what is the future of CES? Is it driverless cars? Is it? I've got three or four questions about CES. Where is it going?
Well, I wish I could say, because I would give anything to come back 50 years from now and see what CES looks like. It's evolving along with where technology does. We have defined consumer electronics to include almost everything that consumers would want inside their home or in a car or on the go. And I think that's our challenge, is always to be up front. When we talk about the future, and we're planning out, we could tell you the show dates for 2029 if you really wanted to know, because we have to. It's a simultaneous equation. We use the convention centers in Las Vegas and like 30 or 40 hotels there. And when you have 150,000 people, logistically, that's what you have to do. But for me to tell you what the categories will be. Now, look, we have about 25 tech zones, we call them, or pavilions of different categories. And if you asked me 5 years ago which would be the ones today, I would have been totally wrong. I wouldn't have been able to talk about the driverless car as one of our tech zones, or various chip things and sensing devices, or so many other things that are out there. We have a robotics tech zone. Maybe I could have talked about that one because I'm a big science fiction reader. But some of the other, I just don't know. You know, our wireless health area is exploding. You know, just this whole concept of just having entrepreneurs there as a standalone category, that's pretty weird for us because it's not category driven. Automobiles now. We have, I think, 8 of the 10 largest car companies, you know, showing cars there because they want to. Because cars used to be sold on horsepower, now they're being sold on technology, and that's a huge change for automobiles. And then there's all this safety-related stuff involving distracted driving and all the issues that come up with that. These are things that are tough to anticipate. So in terms of where we'll be in 5 or 10 years, I don't have a clue, but I know we're going to be out there looking at the trends. And the reason we try to get like-minded companies together, in a sense, is because there's more credibility once a category is created. Sometimes a company will invent something, and it'll, even though it could be very significant, it'll be ignored because no one realizes it's really valuable. I mean, to me, some of the most exciting stuff, I went to a thing at the last CES, which you could go into this little area, and you could put your fingernails in and with a photo or a design, and you could have all your fingernails done in that design, the dress you're wearing that night, and it could be done in a matter of 2 minutes. And now with that, you know, they're selling machines all over the country that will do this. That creates new things for entrepreneurs who just want to start a little business, having people get their nails done. Or there's stuff that could coat your entire electronics product by just dipping it in this fluid that these engineers created. It's just not the outside of the product. It's all the circuitry as well. So it essentially is totally waterproof using nanotechnology. There are things out there which are really, really exciting. And I'm not smart enough to know what the trends will be. But what we will be is a platform for innovation.
So one other question for you is this whole, and this goes back to Steve too, the question of teamwork, of building your team. And this came out of the idea of Steve Jobs, the lone innovator versus the team. How do you build your team, Steve? Now, Gary, in your book, you talk about Thomas Edison, and we all believe that Thomas Edison was a great—he had a great PR machine. But he had a whole corporate organization in place.
There are no lone innovators. Even Steve Jobs, Thomas Edison, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, what they did, if you think about the people they surround themselves with, there are people who complemented their weaknesses. And it's actually, I want to get back to your question about females. There are differences between the sexes. Females are better at empathy and frankly, at teamwork and at cooperating, coordinating. And they are starting to dominate the graduate degrees now in colleges, not maybe in the sciences, but in other areas in terms of sheer graduation rates. I think putting aside people of color and other minorities and things like that, female versus male, females I think are on a very upward curve right now because they have the skills that are needed to be part of these teams. I think the toughest thing, and the biggest, not the biggest, one of the mistakes entrepreneurs make is they try to hire people like themselves. And that's wrong because what makes our nation great, in my view, is that we have phenomenal diversity. We're the most diverse country in the world. You go to the Asian countries, everyone has to agree with everyone else, and that's consensus is what's valued. Here, pushing back is valued, and it's okay. just as is failure. And that's part of what makes us great as a country, where we have these cultural values that are different than other countries. You know, I first thought Mitt Romney was going to fail when his big choice was a guy who could have been his clone, Paul Ryan. I mean, he hired someone just like him. That was a big strategic mistake on his part. He should have gotten someone very different. And, you know, you saw how, you know, Clinton got Gore. They were two pretty different people. And it turned out they kind of split along the way. That was a smart move. I mean, just not geographically, but personality-wise and things like that. And that's you look at the choices that CEOs make for who people they surround them with. That's very, very important. But the teamwork aspect is really, really, you know, it's critically important. When I look at our team and one of our representatives, or one of our senior vice presidents is back there, we are really, really different people. There's no two people there that anyone would say are alike each other. Right, Jeff?
So, Steve, in your experience, and this question that we had lunch with the VC today, Gary and I, and he mentioned that almost all founders get pushed out when the companies get bigger. So, how do you train people, or what's your take on building a team and then maintaining a team as it scales?
You know, one of the real surprises was trying to understand the life cycle of a startup. More importantly, trying to understand the life cycle of a founder. You know, once we kind of have this idea that what you're doing as a founder is searching for a business model, you kind of think that, well, the day I go into a board meeting announcing I have found a repeatable and scalable business model, you kind of clear the aisles because you know that's where they're going to hold the parade, and you think they're going to be throwing confetti and, you know, really kind of excited that you're announcing to the board you found a profitable and scalable way to grow the company. But instead, the board members start staring at each other and then start looking you up and down, making you feel very uncomfortable. And then they give themselves a secret look. And that secret look is time to hire the operating exec. And you're kind of confused because you were thinking you were going to be the CEO of a 1,000-person company. Not understanding that what just happened in the mind of the VCs is what most founders don't understand. If you have a professional investor on your board, while you see one VC every board meeting, they're looking at 10 to 12 other companies. You see one, they're visiting 10 to 12. In fact, when they drove up into your parking lot that day, they had to look up your name. I mean, that's you didn't matter until the day you say profitability. And then all of a sudden, you matter a lot because you might be the liquidity event that pays back their firm. Now, all of a sudden, instead of being the founder who was doing something crazy on Monday, then Tuesday, then Wednesday, flying around the world, you're, in fact, putting their investment at risk. And they want an operating exec that knows how to grow from search to repeatable process to execution. I call this the secret memo that VCs never give the founders. And the survival rate of founders depends on VC firms from as low as 20% to as high as 70%. For example, for Andreessen and Horowitz, they're ex-entrepreneurs. So they tend to select entrepreneurs they know could grow into the job. And they tend to train them about the other skills you need, which are besides search, is how to manage and grow sales, how to put together HR departments, et cetera, whereas other VC firms just kind of parachute in suits, operating execs, which sometimes doesn't go too well.
And so the lesson really is, if you really want to be CEO of your own firm, don't give your equity away to VCs.
I'm not sure that's the lesson. To be honest, I think the
if you want to be a CEO.
I don't think so. I think the lesson is we've done a heck of a bad job in articulating on both sides, from the entrepreneur side, what's the goal, and from the VC side, what are the skills necessary to actually be an operating exec and CEO. Most entrepreneurs will tell you, well, it's their due. Well, no, it's not your due. We're not interested in your due. We're interested in fact having some liquidity event, meaning cashing in, whether it's a sale or an IPO, in a growing company. And from the venture capitalist point of view, no one tells entrepreneurs on day one when you're kind of trying to fund them is, oh, we're going to be the firm that's going to replace you when you're successful. Who's going to do that? So therefore, you never tell them that there are skills you need to know after we use you up in the search mode. Here are the other things you need to know, and if you don't learn those at the same time, we're bringing in your replacement. And that's the. And so I think the whole industry is kind of missing a set of education on both sides, and we could teach this. It's not impossible, and not every founder can actually do this. Let me give you the best examples. Bill Gates went through four presidents of Microsoft, sucking each one of them dry. Okay? Four presidents. Okay? Larry Ellison almost lost his company before his investors made him bring in Ray Lane as the resident adult, sucked him dry, and then Ellison learned a lot. Steve Jobs got fired from his own company, wandered in the wilderness for 13 years, learning how to be a great CEO by learning the value of operating executives underneath him. When he came back to Apple, it was not the same smart-ass kid. This was a senior executive who understood the value of Phil Schiller and John Rubenstein and Johnny Ives, etc., who can actually execute for him, but he still kept the vision. That's what it takes to grow. And if you notice, the irony is, while most founders get fired, the world's largest technology companies, when they were successful, were run by their founders.
And Gary, some of those founders are actually your members and people that you've been...
Everyone he mentioned.
Right. You've been backstage with.
Right.
Absolutely. But I couldn't help but think, you know, I'm a believer in the Murphy principle, is that you're hired, you're promoted to the area of your incompetence. Being a CEO, since I am a CEO of a modestly sized company, it's not an easy job, and it isn't for most people. It is, you're dealing with the future of people's lives, you're dealing with a strategy, you're dealing with HR and emotions, you're dealing with 1,000 things in the air, and your job is never done. That is not for most people. And it's not the same. I mean, the passion that carries you forward as an entrepreneur, yes, some of the skills can be learned. You could certainly learn how to read financial statements and do projections and deal with various legal issues and other issues that anyone has to deal with. But it's not for everyone. That's just a fact. And as I said earlier, a lot of people who built up a company a certain size, they sell out. They're shocked when they sell out and they realize the people who bought their company get rid of them. Well, the reason they bought the company is because they think they can make more money than you're making with it. And they think they're going to do things differently. And they have a different vision than you. This is not rocket science. That's why people buy companies. And they're usually not buying it for the CEO. They're often buying it because of either the intellectual property, the business of the company, or some of the talent, the senior executives, the engineering people, whatever it is. But they're unlikely buying it because of you, the CEO, who's a CEO that's come up through starting a company. And that is the most shocking thing that almost every entrepreneur figures out when they sell their company. And I said to the last one, what could I have said differently to you when you sold your company? And he says, it's like a teenager and a parent. You got to learn it on your own. There's nothing you could have said. Because I said, you will be out of a job within a year and plan for that. You're in the honeymoon now. You're being told great things that it's a partnership and all that. That's not real life. Entrepreneurs sell out and they lose their jobs.
Okay, I got a gossip question for you. A fanboy question. What was it like working with Microsoft and going from Bill Gates to Steve Ballmer?
You know,
aren't they still a client?
When I first, they're both members. I mean, Microsoft is still a very important member of ours. Bill Gates, you know, when he started, the first time I met him, he was like, you know, reading a magazine, walking into the room by himself, and you know, he was a geek. There's no other way of saying it. He was a geek, and he had a vision, and he's not the most charming person in the world, not the most empathetic. And over years, he's learned that skill, actually. He's much, much better. When you see him on TV now talking about his foundation, which he's passionate about, you can't help but think he's taking money and doing some real good with it. Steve is more of a salesman, and he's passionate about selling. Bill was really good about talking about a future and figuring out where things are going. He loved to theorize. I think Steve is more of a brick-and-mortar, nails today, what's going on, finances now, sales now type of guy, and he's strong. But they're different people, which is what people are. They're all different. Every leader every leader has their own sense, and that's what you should be. I think leaders that try to be like somebody else, you're making a mistake. They're both good leaders. I mean, unquestionably, Microsoft, a lot of people have said they're out, but they're not. I mean, they're doing a lot of great things. I think what they've done with Kinect is phenomenal. They're not a one-product company. You know, Windows is huge still, but they managed to create Kinect, which is, to me, is game-changing.
Here's a question for both of you. Is it a good idea, and this is especially for someone from Washington, D.C., is it a good idea to bureaucratize innovation under a VP or a C-level instead of leaving it to individual engineers and entrepreneurs?
You know, when you were talking about that earlier, about the VP of innovation, I kept thinking it used to be the VP of strategic planning. That was a job you had before you were fired. But that's not true with the VP of innovation. They call them CIO even, chief innovation officer in companies. I was speaking before the top of 35 executives of the Department of Homeland Security. I was the only civilian in the room. And in there, there was a chief innovation officer that come from another department of government. And I was, and there was a related one for Homeland Security. I was overwhelmed and impressed by these people. Their job is to take technology and innovation and apply it to the fundamental mission of the Department of Homeland Security. And the things they were talking about were just phenomenal and very impressive. Not the stuff you're reading about today with, like, you know, searching databases and that you may not know about, but more like how you could use technology to track trucks, to predict behavior, to do all sorts of different things. And I think that that was absolutely great. So I believe that that is a real, real position. You know, we're so close to technology industry and technology companies, we have to remember that still 90% of the companies in the country have nothing really to do with technology. They're impacted because they use technology. They're not developing technology. So how they figure out how to use technology is a really a full-time position. And it takes people thinking and knowing, and it's not just consultants, it could be consultants, but there are people who have to know the business they're in and figure out how to take it to the next level using technology, which is a really important thing to do. I felt better at the end, about government at the end of the day. I also felt really sad in a way that, you know, it was a lunchtime meeting and I was starved. And like you, they basically had some people bought food on their own and you put a dollar into a pot to take it. And it's like the ethics rules and everything else have devolved to just this point. They're not allowed to buy lunch for anyone at a meeting. It was really sad, I felt, that these people are phenomenally bright, capable, incredible public servants and they're treated so shabbily by us, the public, because we don't trust them. That was an aside.
Steve, bureaucracy, meritocracy, how do you do it right?
Well, you know, if we knew how to do it right, we'd be doing it.
I thought you were.
Yeah. So, you know, I think in large corporations, the role of the chief innovation officer, it's very funny. We could get hooked on the title that says that means they have to be the chief of innovation. Actually, what they have to do is enable innovation, I think as Gary said, across the enterprise and figure out how to get it into the DNA of existing business units, how to make the process an integrated one, not kind of a command and control system. You know, one of the funny stories and untold stories of Silicon Valley and the Cold War is, if any of you remember history, in the 1980s we were in the end game of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and they had an immense numerical superiority in Eastern and Western Europe over us in tanks and men and artillery, etc. And then Bill Perry became Under Secretary of Defense, and he came out of Silicon Valley, and he realized that the way we were going to beat the Soviet Union was with semiconductors, supercomputers, and intelligence. And we actually built weapon systems based on chips and technology we had that they panicked about, Star Wars being the only visible one that was discussed in the public. But the Soviet Union ended up in an arms race they could never recover from. And I use that as an analog of how, if we're smart, you could beat a competitor who has a monolithic command and control system by using technology in a way that they're just not enabled to go do.
Gary, is that a ninja trick?
Well, certainly. I mean, technology is a tool, and if you're smart and using it, you will win. And, you know, when you think about even how credit card companies came about and what they did, those who were able to process technology and use credit cards in an efficient way, which made a difference, won. And you could point to many different areas. Technology is a competitive differentiator, and it should be. The challenge is that sometimes you're making bad decisions. I've seen companies go under because they've invested in massive software systems which destroyed the company. Not only were they expensive, but they're disruptive in terms of you have to train people to do it, change their business processes, which might have worked. And if you're betting wrong, you're risking the company. It's kind of like patents today. You know, they're just the patents used to be a good thing, and now they're in a sense ruining a lot of companies because it's diversionary. You're taking your best resources, your top engineering talent, legal talent, CEO talent, and you're getting stuck in lawsuits and threatened lawsuits, and that's a dangerous thing. But certainly, innovation is so important in technology and an innovator. It's innovation, we shouldn't say, is just technology. It's innovation practices. It's innovative distribution. It's dealing with people differently. It's coming up with new ways of doing things. It's changing how things are done. And sometimes, I agree with you about going to trade shows, but sometimes the biggest disruptors are people who have nothing to do with an industry. They come in industry because they're willing to think differently, and they're not stuck in that process. You know, the really interesting thing to watch is this lawsuit against Apple by the this crazy lawsuit by the Justice Department. Apple was entering a new area of electronic books, and who would think just because they said, like, if you want to sell electronic books, we're going to take 30%, they were brought and hauled in by the federal government. And it's almost obscene that our federal government would try to shut down Apple because they were entering a market where they had 0% doing something what everyone does in a market when they enter it. They say, you want to do business with us? Here's the deal. This is what you do. It's a very simple model. And there's no rational justification for it. And I am 100% confident that unless Apple settles, Apple will win. And they should win because the federal government has no business going into these things where you're starting and you're innovating and they're coming down with these very vague antitrust laws. And I used to be an antitrust lawyer. That no one knows what they mean, being a bad competitor or other stuff like that. It's crazy. And it's not good for American companies. Again, nothing to do with the question, but I got my point of view in to answer it.
Okay, well, one
that's innovating, by the way.
We've gotten a lot of questions about funding. And we were, before the program, we were talking about funding, where you go. Gary and I had lunch today with a prominent VC who was somewhat critical of all the startup things going on. He said, I don't really want to hear about all these startup things. I don't want somebody that's just going to come to me with an idea and say, give me money. So what's the role of the VC? What's the role of crowdfunding? What's the role of having a really good product and just bootstrapping it? How does that all work?
So, you know, the VC world is changing around us as we speak. Traditional venture capital, while it's the engine of what makes entrepreneurial clusters like Silicon Valley work, you know, we always kind of tell stories about the entrepreneurs, but what we forget is what makes the engine happen is not just the crazy entrepreneurs, but the financial people are equally insane. I mean, what other financial asset class could tell its investors, I'm going to lose 90% of your money and still make money for them? I guess maybe the housing market, but but they forgot the making money part. But the part of this engine that made the Valley work for the last 50 years was this asset class of venture capital. But it used to be a traditional model. If they raised a fund, they do a first round, second round, you know, mezzanine round, take you public, etc. And underneath that was maybe you got raised money from dentists. Now there's an entire hierarchy that's kind of emerged around them. Crowdsourcing, angels, super angels like 500 startups, smaller funds like True Ventures or Floodgate, and even now the large funds have their own seed funds like Andreessen and Horowitz and Menlo and Charles River. So the venture industry is changing rapidly. I think they all kind of wish it was like the old days where everybody needed $5 million, they could own their 20%, et cetera. But the game has changed where you could probably get out of the building, validate some of the key ideas all on your credit cards and laptops, whether it's hardware or software, kind of eliminate a good amount of the risk in a way that you couldn't before. And there are just very few exceptions to that rule. And so if I was a VC who've been in business for 20 years, my head's still spinning around because that old comfortable world is gone. And so the new rules apply. And while I could feel sorry for some of those VCs, and on some point, not really, because they're making 2% management fee every year, whether they win or not. And by the way, that's kind of almost the death of venture capital. For those of you who know, VCs make money on what's called the 2 and 20. They get 2% of the fund for just showing up, and then 20% of what's called the carry. That's the profits. But if your fund is big enough, let's say you've raised $1 billion, you're raking in $20 million a year for your fund just sitting around. And it's been now in the last decade or so an anti-incentive for VCs to actually innovate. So some of the larger funds are now having problems and like, maybe we ought to be innovative again. So I forgot what your question was.
But there are two other things. I mean, there's crowdfunding, which is, we work very hard to get the law passed, which allows crowdfunding. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with Kickstarter. It works. You know, it may not be the most complex products that are created, and you can look at them. And there's other websites which are doing similar things in terms of funding. Also, though, you know, we hear a lot about there's inequality in society, especially in the United States, in terms of wealth. Part of the story is we've gotten a lot of rich Americans through entrepreneurial activity. A lot of them here in Silicon Valley, but the reality is they're all across America. There's a lot of pockets of innovation. I mean, I've spoken to tech councils in North Carolina, in Seattle, in Nashville, in New Jersey, in New York, in Virginia, and elsewhere. And they all think they're the best and next to Silicon Valley. But the truth is there's a lot of wealthy people. Wealthy people, though, are able to invest and fund and do things Some of it is formally on a VC basis, but some of it is they're investing in their kid or their relative or their friend because they believe in them. And it's more of a partnership than, in a sense, than an investment. So there's a lot of money coming in non-traditional ways. There's microloans, which is now an international phenomenon of how you fund entrepreneurs around the world. It's a really good thing. So there's different non-traditional ways of making it happen. And you combine that with the low barriers to entry today of starting a business, especially when it's web-based. You have a really good situation for entrepreneurs. And back to your question of what is it about this guy that we were talking with at lunch, who is a very famous entrepreneur, but he's saying there's only so many entrepreneurs and there's a lot of stupid money following them. You know, I think there's a tremendous amount of innovation out there and there's great people. And it's a free market for funding, and to the extent we as a society encourage investment, even if a lot of it is losing investment, that's a good thing. Not only will there be winners, but it creates economic activity of its own. People learn from their mistakes, they move forward, and they're smarter in their next venture.
So let me riff on that for a second. Kickstarter to me is more like a faith-based investment vehicle in that I encourage startups who are doing small apps to actually go there because it's a great marketing vehicle, but there's zero judgment, right? There's zero judgment. There's no way to kind of oversee the investment, et cetera. And also investments outside of entrepreneurial clusters are friends and family and dumb money. We kind of forget.
Faith-based dumb money.
Yeah,
so, I don't think it's pejorative.
Let me finish. I want to make the pejorative on purpose just to make the point. Because here's what Silicon Valley VCs do horribly, and that is their inability to articulate their pattern recognition skills. That is, as an entrepreneur, you have one startup at a time, and if you had a great career, you'd maybe do 5 or 10. But a great VC has sat on maybe 50 boards, you know, reviewed thousands of deals, sat through hundreds of presentations, and they got to be deaf, dumb, and blind, and stupid to boot, to not have recognized patterns of successful entrepreneurs, successful investors, successful markets, et cetera. And they do a bad job of marketing that pattern recognition skill because actually that's what they add value to when they sit on the board. First in picking great deal flow, great entrepreneurs, and then giving advice of, you know, I've seen this movie before, let me tell you how it's going to play out.
But isn't it true that I agree with all that, but there's also they're humans and they follow trends more than they should. Like
well,
microcomputers are
right.
pet.com companies are now it's cloud computing. Right. It was storage a few years ago. There's
so that's
always
why I
some
said
trend.
It's kind of it's the bad part of their inability to be articulate. So when you have a VC on your board and they say do X, you have to ask them, is it because you didn't have coffee, you just read about it in the journal this morning, or is it pattern recognition of you've seen 15 companies melt down out of this bad move? And I'm half agreeing with you, but I think...
You're half disagreeing with you.
Right. It's kind of like I agree, but. I think the real idea is they actually have some skill in extracting interesting data that if they would take it to the next level and say, let me explain to you why. And I think the Valley has just done a bad job as when they were the only game in town and the only checks that got written. They didn't need to be able to articulate what it is that they've learned in their craft that's valuable to you as the entrepreneur. And I think more and more they're going to find themselves having to explain themselves to entrepreneurs about what it is that they have to offer. And I'll just contend they do have a lot to offer, if not only just from time and grade and seeing enough of these things, much like you've seen a ton in CES. I bet you now look at a booth from 20 yards.
It's only a
right?
booth. I have people pitching me all the time. Right. And within 3 seconds, I could tell you whether I think their business plan has any chance of success.
Right.
And the toughest thing is how you respond to that.
Right.
I mean, when my wife first met me, she thought I was very rude to people when I would tell them the truth. And she said, you understand that person's been waiting to talk to you and explain that to you, and you're not very empathetic. That's why I know about empathy. I've learned about it lately. And you should say it.
Actually, we all learn how to emulate empathy.
So, I mean, the bottom line is that people are passionate about their ideas. Unfortunately, in my view, a lot of the ideas are really, really bad ideas, or they depend upon everyone changing the universe. In my case, a lot of entrepreneurs come and they want their chip or a certain chip put in every consumer electronics product and their brilliant system will work. Well, that's never going to happen. People don't want to put extra chips in their products unless there's an incentive to do that.
Well, unfortunately, we're almost out of time tonight. We do have time for one more question that I have sitting right here in front of me. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Entrepreneurs, Startups, Entrepreneurs, and Ninja Innovation with Steve Blank and Gary Shapiro.
So is this the best question of the night coming
up? This is the best question of the night. I saved the best for last. I've been funded. I plan to stay around as the CEO of this question. And if you didn't get enough of this, we do have both Gary and Steve's books for sale out in front afterwards, and they'll be signing them for you and talking to you. Okay, number one question. Is Silicon Valley going away?
Never. And I'm sure when they asked that question in Detroit in the 1950s, it was the same answer. This is not a one-product company town. Actually, if you really think about the product of Silicon Valley, it's not software or apps or cloud or whatever. Our product is now innovation and entrepreneurship. And Silicon Valley is no longer a physical place of Mountain View and Sunnyvale. It extends from San Jose to San Francisco and across the bay. What we really do here is we take risks that no other place does. And in fact, when I get foreign visitors come see me, I ask them the question is, do you know what we call a failed entrepreneur in Silicon Valley? There's a special English word. And they go, what? What's that word? And I go, well, a failed entrepreneur is called experienced here. And it's a big idea. We embrace failure, not because we love it, not because we want it, but in fact, we understand that learning, discovery, failure, and success is an integral part of the process. And what's great about America and great about the Valley is people come here from all over to not only experience the technology, but to live in the culture in a way that maybe was like Rome or Florence or Paris at their peak. And here we are again, and I'm just happy I'm alive in this time.
Thank you. Gary? Counterpoint?
It's not a counter. I mean, I agree with everything you said, except I wouldn't just apply it to Silicon Valley. I would talk about the country as a whole, because it's a cultural experience about valuing experience and failure. And it's having talked with governments and others around the world on these issues, everyone wants to be like the United States. I was just in Europe a few weeks ago in Amsterdam when the vice chairman of the European Union was giving away the first innovation awards to entrepreneurs. And she said, Nellie Krauss said, we want to be like the United States, where entrepreneurship is encouraged. So it is an attitude we have. It's the number one brand is Silicon Valley. When you're the number one brand, as we are with trade shows, the danger is always arrogance. You have to be paranoid. You can't assume the rest of the world is standing still. And the rest of the world has figured out what goes on here. And the rest of the country and the rest of the world is trying to emulate it. Now, there are some disadvantages cropping up. It's a very expensive place to do business, not only in terms of real estate, but in terms of talent. There are a lot of other pockets around the country and around the world which you're trying to challenge, and that's reality. Parting comment, since I have just invested heavily in living in Detroit in a new home there, I have to say Detroit has come back remarkably, and you might count out Detroit, but Detroit's strategic advantage is they have a phenomenally skilled and underutilized workforce that is dying for work at this point. And now the real estate market is on fire there, and people are manufacturing there, and the auto industry and related industries are doing well. Every segment has something they're really, really good at. Silicon Valley has some strengths and tremendous strengths in software and hardware and chips and other things. But other pockets of the country are doing well, like whether it's biotech in Maryland or it's in Northern Virginia. There's a lot of internet-based services in so many other areas of the country I could tell you about. They're doing great also. So the danger, as with any number one enterprise, though, is arrogance and just assuming that it's your God-given right to be there forever. You have to be paranoid. And I'd be paranoid here because, frankly, it is expensive. California has chased away a lot of companies. That's just a reality and a fact. And the rest of the country and governors and other states are here pouncing and enticing other companies to go away from California.
Great. Well, thank you both. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club. I'd like to thank our audience listening at home. Our program tonight has been Startups, Entrepreneurs, and Ninja Innovation with Gary Shapiro and Steve Blank. We're out of time tonight, so with this, I would like to close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion.